Innovation, disruption, and big issues. This is Business Game Changers with Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. One thing that we've covered a lot in this show is the lack of justice. You know, our justice system is broken. There's many sources of that problem. And it seems that the weak in our society, the vulnerable groups in our society, are the ones that are seeming to always get the short end of the stick when it comes to justice. They don't have the resources. They often don't get representation in court. People might say that everyone has representation, but the public defenders are so overworked that they get about 8 minutes per client that they have. So essentially, they're not represented. This is going on all over the world. There are many crimes that are committed that are being done by people of power that, I mean, we've seen that in the whole banking system, you know, with the 2008 crash. No one was really prosecuted and brought to justice for that. So if you have power and you're in high places, you can do a lot of things, pretty much do anything. You only get prosecuted or marched around, paraded out in the public if the powers that be want to make an example out of you for some reason. Or if you're not in the inner circles and you do something dumb, even if you have a lot of money, they might not care because you don't mean anything to them. So we see a lot of that. But there's a group of people that came together and created this International Tribunal for Natural Justice, and really high profile people, Noam Chomsky and others, that came together and created this group. And they did it on the 800th anniversary of the Magna Carta. And they started it 2 years ago. And I'm bringing on one of the founders. His name is Sasha Stone. And he's going to talk about what this International Tribunal for Natural Justice is, what their goals are, and what they're working on now. And it gets this kind of becomes a dark show because we start talking about human trafficking. But Sasha has a way of being a light in the darkness. He's always uplifting and enlightening. And so I think even though this is a dark show that people don't want to talk about, people don't like sexual abuse. They don't like human trafficking. If we could just stay away from it, they would. In fact, all the media stats show that when you cover this type of topic, people run from it. And so from a business standpoint, they don't want to cover it, which is really sad because this is something that really needs to be covered. It's important that for protecting our children and for protecting the vulnerable in our society, that everybody is aware of this. So I'm going to bring on Sasha Stone, and he's going to talk to us again about the International Tribunal for Natural Justice and what they're working on. So let's get right into that interview now.
Hi, Sasha. Welcome to the program.
Delightful to meet you, Sarah. Thank you.
You have a lot going on. You are creating a lot of different things, but I want to talk about this big venture that you have going on called the International Tribunal for Natural Justice. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I can. The ITNJ, or the International Tribunal for Natural Justice, was established almost 2 summers ago. And we had a ceremonial seating in the United Kingdom, in London. And the following day, we had a treaty ratification at Central Hall in Westminster, which is the seat of government here in England. And historically, it was an important day that we chose to launch the International Tribunal because it was the 800th anniversary of the signing of the Magna Carta, which is effectively the source code of law as it's commonly understood around the world. What we were doing in establishing the International Tribunal was creating and manifesting an international court which represented the living men and women of the living soil and not fictions, not corporation governments and multilateral institutions and special interests and lobbies and all the other godless systemic corruption that we have seen usurp and take over our institutions of in government of the executive, the judiciary, and so on. So the ITNJ was really a united effort on the part of thousands of people around the world within our network to come together and to treaty a new court under the purest form of law, which is natural law, and to put thumbs to paper, to the treaties and signatures, and to effectively mandate the formation of a new court representing the people of the world. And that's exactly what it was. So we have expertise in law. Many, many experts around the world informed the process. And here we have the International Tribunal for Natural Justice. It's taken us some time. We've had multiple hearings in the last year and a half. And we have now begun establishing our first judicial commission of inquiry into human trafficking and child sex abuse. So we've really now, we're getting onto our feet now properly.
Well, you had, when you formed this, you had a great coalition of people from all different parties and different places, and it was a really broad coalition. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes, happily so. And like all coalitions, some of it works and some of it doesn't work. And that's all right and proper. And that's part of the formative, natural formative process of getting anything off the ground in this world. We had huge support from somewhat iconic figures from around the world. I could name a number of them here. Bishop Ria Abwalasal from Jerusalem, who's one of our commissioners. Dawn Alexander, MBE, a very hallowed and iconic woman in the United Kingdom here, who's been honored by the Queen, for if that matters to some. We had Paul Craig Roberts, former Deputy Secretary to the United States Treasury. I believe it was under the Reagan administration. Dr. Stephen Greer, Michael Tellinger, a number of iconic people representing very, very different demographics around the world. We had seven or eight nations represented diplomatically at the ceremonial seating. A member of the House of Lords in the United Kingdom attended. We had our Chief Justice, Sir John Walsh of Branner, and many other notables. And we also had many thousands and thousands of people looking in. That was the most important bit. And of course, a packed out theater, standing only. Many people wanting to.
Well, you also had Noam Chomsky involved. He did a special video for you. That was really quite interesting. Yeah.
Yes, indeed. He very graciously spoke to the Magna Carta at our request. And that was very, very delightful piece to put in there for the intelligentsia. And yes, forgive me, but there were a great many other great and good souls that escaped my immediate reference.
Oh, well, that's okay. I'm just glad that you're bringing all sorts of different people together. What are the main issues that you have found the organization focusing on? I mean, what you've touched a little bit, but what are you, you know, what have you identified?
Well, in the first instance, let me explain that we have a Chief Justice, we have affiliated justices, judges, we have court officers, we have trustees of the tribunal, and then we have members and all around the world. So we have something of a broad system or structure around the actual court. The hearings that the court was receiving and the applications that were being received were from people from South Africa to Canada. And First Nation peoples from different parts of the world wanting to challenge the legitimacy of the corporation governments in their territory. For instance, the good people of the Aotearoans, the Maori of New Zealand, wanting to challenge the fictitious government of New Zealand. So we had very interesting cases like that come before us, or applications being made. The same with sub-Saharan kings and chiefs, paramount chiefs of Africa, wanting to bring cases before the court, again, to challenge the legitimacy of the corporation government of the Republic of South Africa, which, for instance, is ultimately a franchise of the British Crown and the Vatican, essentially, or the parent corporation. So we have an awakening of indigenous or First Nation peoples around the world, variously narrowing their focus into the court and recognizing that the International Tribunal is the first court mandated to be able to take on their kind of case. What we discovered was that there was a lot of infighting amongst the various contingents who were making representations to us. So we kept on having to break up fights before things even got to a court case. So it got a little bit silly. We began to change our focus into, hang on, let's try and create unified claims. Let's take on the big picture. So for instance, the business of human trafficking, slavery, and of course, pedophilia, which incorporates things like ritual satanic abuse, gets into even more ghastly things like human organ harvesting and ritual sacrifice. Grotesque subjects that most of us do not want to get to grips with and most people turn away from. But for those who know what is underpinning our civilizational model, you are forced to recognize that these things are as real can be. Not only that, but they are endemic. Human trafficking is endemic. Ritual satanic abuse is endemic. Child sacrifice and ritual child sex abuse is endemic. And we determined, after hearing so many grisly stories coming in, that we should create a unified, take on a unified position, put together an international panel of judges, which we've done and we continue to do, and establish a commission of specially appointed commissioners just to address that particular judicial commission of inquiry, and then open the floor up to people of the world who want to come forward with their testimonials, their expert witnesses, affidavits of truth connected to the story of human trafficking and child sex abuse. And that's what we've begun galvanizing. That will formally launch whenever the court announces it on its circular on the website. But my understanding from having spoken to the trustees is that the judicial commission will formally kick off in autumn of this year.
So at this point, do you foresee it having official jurisdiction anywhere, or just are you getting high enough profile and trying to make it high enough profile that the countries, the states, will have to look at it?
We don't have to do that because that's already been done. I mean, the Trump administration has begun that process. The president of the United States made that black and white statement that he was taking on human trafficking head on, I think within days, if not a couple of weeks of taking office. So, and he's done it. We understand that was at the behest of his daughter and some special groups that had been lobbying to tell the story. But the point being that the American government itself is declared outright war on human trafficking and pedophile rings. So with those mass arrests taking place and what have you, most of it obscured and almost none of it covered by mainstream media, surprise, surprise. Mm-hmm. And that becomes the big issue. And that, frankly, is what we should be talking about. We should be talking about the CEOs, chairmen, and commissioning editors of news desks in the primary news network organizations, especially those that are mandated as public bodies to represent the public interest. We should be talking about those deviants and what conspiracy bonds them in silence against this particular story.
Well, I had the local, for our state, the SBI spokesman came on and talked about child sex trafficking and talked about the fact that they're trying to tackle it. Jeffrey Van Nest is his name. And so inside the FBI, there are really great people that are trying to get this done, and they're taking it very seriously. It is very disappointing that the media isn't being more out there with it. And so people know, because people need to know that it's being taken seriously, because if you're not taking it seriously, the majority of the people are mad as hell. if you will. And they, it's important that they know that the authorities are taking it seriously.
Well, Sarah, you're right to talk about members of the intelligence community already taking the matter very seriously and trying to action things. Unfortunately, they seem to be a somewhat slim majority, or at least a minority, at least those who are speaking out. I know that it's very, very difficult for members of those that apparatus to come forward. I made a film about a year and a half ago with one of the most prolific senior serving FBI officers of 30 years. And she told us on that film, and it's out there, that the summation of her 3 decades in law enforcement and investigations led her to also come up against effectively Satanism and ritual killing and trafficking and these grisly subjects. So we had it verified from a very long-standing and hallowed source within the FBI. And then, of course, as you must know, former clandestine operations officer Robert David Steele from the CIA has become one of the ITNJ Judicial Commission commissioners recently. And he's speaking on this subject very, very loudly. And a man of his pedigree, a man who actually formed a U.S. Marine intelligence after he left the CIA, and he knows full well about the subject and is speaking to it. There are Dr. Pijnik, many others speaking about it. But of course, again, they are not silenced per se. It's very difficult to silence a former heavyweight CIA officer because it will cause a shitstorm. It's in the same way that it's not that easy to silence an activist like myself, who has a pretty loud voice and an incredibly wide network of political, academic, diplomatic, and celebrity support, because it would also cause a shitstorm. So that's where we're at. We're at a psychological standoff, a war, if you will, a psychological war between the truth sayers and those who would prevent the truth from emerging. And the intelligence military industrial complex, as Robert David Steele will attest, is endemically involved in this business of trafficking and has historically been so. That's a horrific story for people of the world to wake up to and recognize that your own friendly government and military apparatus has been involved, oftentimes unwittingly, in the business of pedophile rings and human trafficking and all the rest of it. But we have to understand that within the military, it's very compartmentalized. So you can have career military men, and you do, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of them, who know nothing of the story, nor will they ever know about it, because it's kept from them. In the same way that the secret societies and these occultic little sequestered cloistered clubs, secret societies and Freemasonic lodges and so on around the world create a network of good citizens, worthy citizens doing honorable humanitarian works, but compartmentalized within their ranks by design are very dark, very egregious networks operating and conducting effectively the work of the devil.
Well, the organ trafficking is really widely known. I mean, it's actually in pretty prestigious, you know, papers, pretty prestigious research documents. They know that's out there, and that's not as hidden per se as the satanic stuff. I mean, that the satanic stuff seems so out there. It's hard for people to get their arms around that. The organ trafficking, maybe it's easier for people to believe because it's they understand that somebody would go to all lengths to keep a loved one alive. And so they understand that killing somebody to get someone's organ is, of course, that's happening. You know, it's awful. We know that in China they're doing it. There's been some widely distributed pieces that they're doing it with prisoners. Horrible. But it's beyond that. And that's what you're saying, the sex trafficking. I also did a story with Mari Frankel, who did a story on the foster care system. And her point is over 50% of those kids have been sexually abused. And I think a lot of the children that you're talking about probably come out of that system, at least in this country.
That sounds about right to me, correct. So what that teaches us is that many, if not most, if not all, of those institutions that have been seeded and financed by the public purse in order to protect children and slavery and minorities or minority demographics, many, most, if not all, are involved one way or the other in this grotesquerie. And again, I have to say, in defense of those innocent people who work within these institutions, the majority of them know nothing of this, and nor will they, because by design, they're kept from it. Well, special secret handshakes and all the rest of it have been designed over centuries for a very good reason. It's so that people identify themselves to themselves. We know from the so-called Pizzagate, so-called Podestagate stuff that's come out recently, that there is a language, a codification language of symbols that are used, and trigger words that are used, even in emails and in logos of high street shops and restaurants, that is code amongst Satanists and amongst pedophiles for get your franchise here or get your merchandise here. Disgusting stuff to you or I to awaken to, but there you have it. It's desperately serious stuff.
Well, and the codes are like that in every bad guy industry. When it comes to drugs, it comes to any kind of major industry where there's a huge amount of black money going on, there's codes developed. And this and the FBI have come out and been very open about this. These are the codes that are going on for this particular industry, which is human trafficking.
Why is that not on page one of every newspaper on earth? Yeah. Why are the governments not taking out double page spreads in the International Herald Tribune, in the New York Times, in the London Times, and educating people, teachers, citizens of this stuff? Because it is endemic and systemically linked to the highest echelons in government, historically and generationally. That is why.
Well, and if we can get this information out to the people who are really actively involved in those organizations, you know, because I talk to a lot of people who are involved in the foster care who really care about children, and they're the ones saying that it's an epidemic as far as sexual abuse. They aren't aware of all the satanic and all that other stuff because they just aren't aware. Like you were saying, there's so many good people. They're just beside themselves with the number of abuse. But if they were aware of the symbols, if they were aware of what to look for, and you got that whole army of people aware, like you were saying, it would make a huge difference as far as knocking this stuff down. You'd have a whole army of people.
Sarah, who own good people like you and I have been doing that for decades, for centuries, trying to get the truth to prevail within the status quo. Good luck, baby. I mean, we are always up against the establishment and the established order. Again, Bill founds itself and builds its edifices upon our very bones and upon our the letting of our blood. So sorry to speak in such grisly terms, but that's the way it pans out, has done historically, certainly since the 1700s, with the emergence of the so-called Bavarian Illuminati, which is not to be sniffed at and is no conspiracy theory. It is pure science and pure history of how evil took root and began to contaminate all of the arteries of our civilizational model in order to, do its own bidding and prevent the awakening of our species, of our people, of this world. And here we have ourselves in the 21st century governed by protocols which themselves are laid down by those very deviants, essentially. A mainstream academia locked into a highly toxic, highly reductive and stupefied model of, you know, Einsteinian, Cartesian, Newtonian bullshit reality, nothing to do with the quantum holonomic reality that we are and the sort of immanent divinity that permeates our fabric of reality. God forbid we should speak about our true power, our true capacity as living engines of divinity. You know, we must just shuffle along to the informed wisdom. So academia is locked down again in these in this kind of systemic dystopia, and it's very controlled dystopia. And if you step out of that line, you don't get your PhD, you don't get your degree, and you can't move forward in this world, and you can't put food on the table for your family. So it really is an assault. Academia and the way it is structured is a direct assault against basic survival of humanity, in the same way that mainstream media is locked down in only drip feeding a very informed narrative, and any commissioning editor or publisher who steps beyond that bound is no longer invited to the feast. And so we find that lockdown is left to good, honorable journalists like yourself to be at the vanguard of truth saying. But I suggest to you that you and I and our friends and our family and every hominid with a pulse that we can bring into this should be creating another international judicial commission of inquiry into the sequestration of technologies in the basement of the military-industrial complex and control narrative of truth-saying in media. These should be things that we go against, organize ourselves against, and the only way ultimately we can do it is by speaking to the truth and then hearing the truth. And that's what a judicial commission of inquiry is intended to do.
And don't you think if we stay with things that the average person would understand, like the sex trafficking, you can get that they don't like it. Anything that's very clear, hidden, you know, the non-transparency that's going on in our government, things, you know, the constant wars. We have just a ton of suicides, so there's a lot of sickness going on from our military veterans. There's a lot of things that we could bring forward and people could bring forward without losing them. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, that they would be 100% for, and that we could really get people to just clean up and be first of all, have basic ethics and morals. I mean, and then you can get into some of the stuff you're talking about as far as raising our consciousness and looking at what we truly are and all these other things.
I mean, that's a natural function, Sarah. That consciousness is a natural unfoldment and function of allowing light to flow into one's own body and one's own form. The minute you start to rid yourself of the toxicity of the informed narrative, the one that brings about cancer in the cell, because it's in such violation of natural laws, mind, body, and spirit, that it brings about sickness. It brings about dysfunction and malfunction and dystopia and scarcity and fear and all of those ghastly constructs which the established order absolutely wants to maintain, because that's how you lock down a slave species and harvest billions of people's time and energy into money, for instance, and into controlled population reduction and all the rest of it, which is where you have government and multilateral institutions that step in and start to orchestrate and organize that bidding on behalf of these established elites and generational lines. Because we're talking essentially about lineages, you know, a small grouping of very, very privileged families effectively at the center of this quote-unquote conspiracy. And to avoid talking about that subject is folly. And I'll say something else. When you tell the truth and speak the truth to someone, even someone uneducated, arguably, especially to someone uneducated, they know it, they feel it, and they respond to it. But when you couch your language and you try to make things digestible and try to speak about things in a diplomatic way that, you know, is, you couch it, no. This is where you actually lose it, and some people get it, some people don't. I'm really of the mind nowadays that we have to broadcast from the center. We have to stand up and we have to walk in a straight line, and we have to stand in that flame of truth and not step out of it to get our foot in the door or to, you know, appeal to a broader audience and so on. I believe that we must all just stand in truth now. There is no more time for couching. Every moment that we're couching and shape-shifting in order to appeal to the lesser sensibilities of the world, people are dying. It's war, disease, and poverty prevails because of the absence of truth in this veil of tears.
So you're saying that unless we go right down the middle, go to the fact that the Illuminati, this family, all this stuff, unless we talk that truth, it's going to be impossible to get people to understand how damaging sexual abuses and wars and all these things, how it's killing our societies.
Yes, because people will never understand why infants are sodomized unless they understand the real reason. Because the real reason is not that a Catholic priest necessarily, if it's a Catholic priest, is getting sexual gratification from it. It is not to do with sexual gratification in the main. In the main, sodomizing an infant is about inverting the so-called kundalini or life force of that infant. This is where the sacrifice of innocence, Canaanite ritualism, prophecy spoke about this thousands of years ago. We just don't bloody listen. Inverting the life force of an innocent child is the quickest, most expedient way of bringing stolen life force or prana into one's own body. Drinking of blood in ritual satanic practice is also about imbibing life force, photonic life force. This is chemistry. When you're drinking innocent blood of innocence, especially if it's adrenalized, it creates a rush, almost like a cocaine, to someone who's in this dereliction, state of dereliction.
And they get addicted to it, right? Like you said, like cocaine.
Yeah.
Is it an addiction like a drug, or does it actually help them as well?
It can sustain their lives, their bodies, their form. But again, you have to ask yourself, is that a human being sodomizing an infant? No, it's not. It's a lower astral intervention. It's a demonic possession, so to speak, to use very reductive language. So again, stand in truth, walk in a straight line, broadcast from the center, do not step out of that flame. Why? Because to step out of that flame of pure truth is to compromise and to abrogate your sovereign expression, your conscience. And if you violate your conscience, you put permissions out there to be interposed or to be interfered with by lower astral intelligences, by all sorts of subtle influences. This is known to everyone on earth, whether you're a shaman or whether you're a Christian or a Muslim or a Taoist. It doesn't matter. We know that we must listen to our inner counsel. And our inner counsel does not sanction the taking of life, does not sanction war, does not sanction any of these atrocities.
Well, I know in teaching ethics, which I teach, I did this last semester, when you have a separation of space, a separation of distance, then atrocities and things can happen, which is why I think war and that kind of killing people rationalize. I don't think anybody would ever rationalize the hurting of babies. Just, I don't even know how that could even be remotely accepted. But what I think people need is they need to believe it's happening. And you are putting out a documentary, right, that documents it and shows more what's going on. Are you getting right to the root of this stuff?
No, I'm not in the documentary. I am not going into that stuff in the way that and you would expect a documentary to. The film I'm making is connecting some leading voices in the world into unison on the subject of human trafficking and child sex abuse. That's all. It's raising the ghost, raising the specter. But it's not an investigation into it, and it's not something that's, some remote region to try and catch human trafficking in action. It's not that kind of a film, not that kind of documentary.
Does it
But
spec?
yes, I'm involved in it, and I don't think it's going to be released for some time because I think it's going to take some months of labor before we choose to release it.
Now, are you getting at the numbers? Do you know how big of a deal this is? I mean, like, what are we talking about? Are we talking, like when I talk to the people who deal with children in foster care, they're talking, at least 50% of these kids are sexually abused, but that isn't necessarily the number that is being trafficked. So do we know what kind of numbers we're talking about?
I would tell you happily that one of the founders of the Federal Child Tracking Agency in the United States came to see me nearly 10 years ago in the United Kingdom. And I will not name the individual, but for obvious reasons. But he came and we spent 2 days here. He put a whole bunch of files on my desk at that time. This must have been 8 or 9 years ago. And he begged. He was a man in his, I believe, in his 60s, mid-60s. He had been involved in this, having founded this agency 30 odd years ago, I believe it was at that time. And he was begging me, begging our foundation to take on these files. He said, therein lies the truth of the number of children disappeared every year. And at that time, he assured me it was between 650 and 800,000 per year.
Gosh, and that's that worldwide?
No, in North America.
In North America. Okay. That's a very large number.
Yes.
And they get away with it because the children that are in the foster system, nobody's tracking. They take the
It's not. It's not just foster. My understanding from those conversations over those 2 days was that essentially it was kids from Black and Hispanic type families who weren't registered and were essentially illegal, and so it was very, very difficult for their parents or their neighborhood to come forward and report this officially because it would have rumbled the whole family. So, I mean, think about the tragedy connected to that, to not being in a position where you can't even report this.
Well,
But
that's another reason why illegal immigration needs to be taken care of, because these poor children, it's so anytime you can get at people, that's a weakness they have. They can't formally go after it. It's the same as the kids in foster care. I didn't think about that whole group of people. It's people that can't, the children who are in foster care are orphans, no one's going to go after them really, unless they have a volunteer that's been following them. And then the ones that are in the country illegally don't have any official recourse. Oh, that's
And
terrible.
they represent this vulnerable group, represent the underbelly of society. So they're so vulnerable, but they have no recourse beyond tragic.
Very much. Okay, so what else are you working with this tribunal? Are you have you been looking at the war in Syria? Because one thing about Syria that I've learned, I actually have a book out there with Senator Black that I published our interview and put some more information together with that as well. One thing that I'm learning that is if, or I learned and I was appalled to learn so much of that if he falls, that the research and the people are saying that we're going to have a mass slaughter of the entire region. There's probably going to be over 4 million people that are going to be killed. And I'm wondering where you are with that
Well,
situation.
I'm very familiar with this kind of politic because my foundation have been engaged for nearly 20 years in backroom diplomacy connected to war zones and to the developing nations of the world trying to throw the devil off their back. Of course, one is not surprised by what's happening in Syria. The Anglo-American corporation and the owners of the corporation have been slowly making their way through every sovereign nation on earth for the last century or two, and gutting each nation along the way until only a handful remained a few years ago, including Afghanistan, Libya, Iraq, and so on. And that's why we've seen these so-called rogue states being demonized by the Associated News networks hand in glove with these treasonous, fraudulent First Nation governments. And once those countries have been demonized sufficiently by propaganda in the media and good citizens and democratic voters will then find it palatable to allow their military machine to go and ransack the country like happened in Iraq, and everyone huddled around their TV screens eating popcorn whilst we were blitzkrieging the living shit out of millions of souls, watching, you know, these infernos unfold. But it was just so much entertainment for the Western mind. If that's not Saturnian and Luciferian, I don't know what is. But that became a part of our new meta psychology of acceptance, is to be able to look at war games on a video console and look at the black and white murder of men, women, and children on real-time TV and not to distinguish the two. So that became something which, in a sense, hypnotized our Western culture into a very egregious or a position of discompassion, the absence of empathy. And so we then, you know, ran into Libya, same, dreamt up Colonel Gaddafi as being some monster. Of course, it turns out after the fact, well known to people at the time, that he was actually something of an emancipated leader in many respects. But we laid to waste Libya and ransacked their interests. And by best accounts, your own State Department at the time was involved in the murder of your own ambassador in Libya, Ambassador Stevens. And that Benghazi story has not gone away and will not be going away anytime soon. And move that narrative from Libya, of course. Let's not discuss that. Let's now look to Syria, and let's foster and incubate a disturbance in the region between Turkey and other countries. So here we have it. No one knows what's right or wrong and who's good or bad, because there's so much confusion thrown at us. So it's like, oh, as long as the problem goes away, we're happy. It gets to the point where the voting public just want the government to deal with it and make the problem go away. And right or wrong no longer plays a part in the equation. So morality is completely gone through this myopic worldview. And the absence of empathy is now completely entrained into the population who are doing the attacking and doing the violations of natural law. And after Syria, of course, it is Iran, which is end game. So Syria and North Korea were always intended to be dreamt up as the bogeymen in Southeast Asia and the Middle East in order to foment a full-on, full battle between Iran and Israel, which is to say Iran and the United States of America and its allies. And that is where you see the Huntingtonian clash of civilizations being manifested, engineered from within the basement of the Pentagon, of Washington, of Whitehall, and of Brussels. And that is intended, of course, as part of a greater Zionist narrative, which is to also bring about essentially this proverbial World War III, which, to anyone who has any nous, knows full well, World War III has been upon us for some time. It was always intended to be a psychological war principally, but ultimately it is also designed to bring about catastrophic failure of social ecology and the social economy of the planet, so that out of the ashes of that pandemonium, engineered pandemonium, will emerge a new world order, the one that the grizzly Bush Sr. spoke about many years ago.
Well, you know, it always amazes me, you know, when Madeleine Albright talked about, she was asked point blank whether the 500,000 children and parents that were murdered or killed in the war, whether that was worth it. And she thought it was worth it. But yet we attack and we smear a leader supposedly for killing 100 people with gas, which we all know it was the story is incredibly suspicious. But we can say that killing, you know, millions of people is worth it while we are pointing our finger at somebody for killing 100 people. And the week after those 100 people were killed, there were even more people killed by our forces.
You know, we get into such inverted logic here. I'll be blunt with you. It's not even worth speaking to us because it's so grotesquely insulting to any intelligence. But you're absolutely right, of course. That is the dystopia, the engineered dystopia and the complete malfunction of morality and the absence of empathy that I was speaking about. That's the new hybridized civilizational complex. It's just at a complete loss as to what is right or wrong or up or down. This is called helter-skelter. This is a language that brings great delight and joy to the, you know, what I would coin the Babylonian priests who are still governing from behind the veil, albeit on the back foot. I'm certainly of the view that the Saturnian interests are on the decline and on the back foot, and that the battle, in a sense, has already been won. I'm personally not that worried about a conflagration taking place in the Middle East and a world war breaking out and, you know, a return to the throne of Solomon and all that grisly stuff. I don't believe we're going into that space. I believe that timeline is no longer an option, that we've already overcome essentially the very worst of what it was in the basement, psychologically speaking, which again is why things like judicial commissions of inquiry and truth and reconciliation commissions and rapprochement, communicating and truth saying and shedding light, which can only happen if we walk in a straight line, if we anchor ourselves in truth and don't couch our language. And more than anything, do not root our lives or our expression in fear and fearfulness, because that is the gravest crime of all, is for me to be sitting in my home in a state of fear, which paralyzes my capacity to do right action in this world. And that absence of right action equates to people being butchered on the streets and in foreign lands without me standing up and speaking about it. And of course, ultimately, there's a knock on my door and they come for me too. And there's no one left to defend me.
So when we look at the big picture here, who are the people that are really pushing for this global empire? And you're saying it's a bloodline, but it's really a group of people who have the most money in this world, right? And who of those people who are the most powerful, because there's some people who have money, probably aren't as sucked into it. So who are these people?
I'm not the man to point and say it's X, Y, and Z. I've got a very clear idea in my own mind of X, Y, and Z, but it's just not, I'm not the one to be naming names. I'm not that kind of a researcher. I know what I've learned and what's been taught to me and told to me by members of those very ranks. So I'm fairly certain in my own mind. One only needs to look very closely at the shareholders, the owners of the Federal Reserve banks in the United States. One only needs to look at the owners and stakeholders of the parent corporation. Look at the powers behind the Vatican interests and so on. And you start to build up a very keen pathology of who's who and what's what. Most of the people who are in power in the world at the tip of the pyramid, they are not evil, and they are not even aware sometimes of what's going on in the basement. But there is a separation between the capstone of that pyramid and the body politic, and there is an intercessionary level there, and that is where, by and large, the priesthood that I'm referring to harbors themselves and acts as a disconnect between the leadership and the body politic. So the leadership is driven in a particular way, and the body politic is saying, hey, we want to go in that direction, but the leadership is driving in that direction. And there's a disconnect, and it's the intercessionary or the priesthood that stands between the two that is doing the subverting. And who are the agents of subversion? There are more of them, one imagines, than you and I would care to imagine. That much I've certainly learned from the films I've made on Satanism and on generational Satanism and on how many practicing Satanists, for instance, are purported to exist in the United States of America alone. If you knew the demographic, it is staggering.
So what is that number? Do we have what those numbers are?
The very best, most informed opinions that we've received from people in those ranks themselves, whistleblowers and survivors of ritual Satanism, generational Satanism, it's anywhere between 9% and 11% of the entire population.
Oh, that's pretty significant. And they hide it because they can't go forward with it in light in the public because people wouldn't accept it. So do they know it's bad, or they just, why?
They do bring it out into the public domain. It's thrown in our face. It's called Eyes Wide Shut. It's what makes Beyonce and Jay-Z and so many of these luminaries in Hollywood and in the music scene so incredibly popular. They are couched in the language of Satanism, of Canaanite ritualism, of Baphomet, of Moloch, of all of this nonsense. The paraphernalia, the costumery, the symbolism is everywhere. In mainstream entertainment, for instance, in sporting events, in NFL and the biggest sporting events in around the world, the Olympics ceremonies, the ceremonial opening up of tunnels and of big buildings, invariably at a certain level contain also the symbolism, well known, well understood to those who have the trained eye. Mm-hmm. I mean, if anyone interested in this particular subject, I would suggest brush up on Mark Passio and Jay Parker, some extraordinary brains out there and people who know a great deal more than I do.
But they have to couch it in symbols and language that the masses don't connect with. They don't come out and say, you know, we're Satanists.
Look, it's like this. I'm going to try and patchwork something for you here. You mentioned earlier about you know, babies being killed, for instance, and it's impossible to understand the logic or the rationale for somebody wanting to drink the blood of an innocent infant and then ritualistically kill the infant. But you see, at a different level, coming at it from a completely different perspective, the individual doing the culling knows that that may not know, but that the infant at the soul level is offering itself up for sacrifice. Everything happens because it is intended to happen. Nothing is happenstance. So there are compacts and covenants at the soul level that you and I are making, which bring about all sorts of events in our lives, some of them horrendous, that we can't compute with the temporal brain, but have a very, very different resonance and understanding in the transmigration of the soul from life to life, from form to form. So if one looks at it in a different way and understands that the infant being sacrificed in a particular ritual has covenanted at the soul level to be in that time and place and is indeed devoured by some diabolical entity, but that is the seeding of light inside that diabolical entity. And at a very, very high level, and I mean a supernatural level, that seeding is the absolution principle, the seeding of light into the heart of darkness, which will ultimately turn that dark entity on its own trajectory and bring it towards the light. It will go through the fires of hell to get to the light, but at least that seeding has taken place. So you see, if you really step back from this temporal world and try to see it from a very heightened spiritual, non-identifying perspective, there are different principles at work that are very hard for you and I to understand, because you and I are feet on the ground, psychologically reflexive, emotionally entrained, and we are essentially based on fight or flight principles. But there are different, far more subtle and far more intelligent processes taking place in the exchange, even in ritual Satanism, that are known at the soul level to both entities, but not necessarily in the temporal sense.
Well, Regina Grimes, do you know who she is?
No.
Okay, well, she's been studying this for a long time and talking about afterlife and what the souls are making decisions and things. And I'm assuming that's kind of where you're coming from. Where have you gotten your knowledge when it comes to what happens at the soul level? I mean, where can people learn more about this, and how do you come to that conclusion?
Because I was the creature you're describing. I was the man who was so profoundly injured and offended by reality. As I began to see, I grew up in a war in Africa first. I was stateless for 10 years without a passport. I was butchered into submission by states and the fictions of governments and states. And I then got into rock and roll and did my kind of primal scream thing. And I then purposed my life at a given point. I wanted to just break out of that, the fallacy of rock and roll, of entertainment, and I purposed myself toward my soul's leaning, which was identification not with false light, but really investigating reality, real reality, and immersing myself in that place. And I went around the world for many, many years, this is well documented, and met with countless leaders in all, you know, spiritual disciplines, in religions, faiths, governments, all around the world. And I conducted the conversations as a living man. And I went on foot to do that. So I've been to very remote places and met extraordinary people, and I've had the conversations. And on that journey, I was informed variously sometimes by leaders themselves, who patronized me and said, well, you need to know this, that this is how the world works. So I stopped being so idealistic when I was about 35 years old. And I started to go, hang on, it's not just about, you know, bringing the Jews and the Muslims together and the Christians together at a meeting in the United Nations to try and get them to, you know, roll up their sleeves. There is no possibility of them rolling up their sleeves and finding any kind of peace, because that bishop will be removed from office long before his initiative gets ratified. And that president who wants to make peace with that president has only got 2 years left in his democratic tenure, and he's only got 3 years left. So I began to learn that democracy itself, for instance, is designed to prevent any change. So you vote a prime minister or president in, he's got 4 years to make the changes. He spends the first 3 years defending himself from attack on all sides, and the last year getting ready to transition power and create some kind of legacy. But invariably, the great dreams that he harbored or she harbored will not be able to take root.
And that's all we have for you today, folks. This is just part one of my two-part interview with Sasha. You'll be able to hear the next part on Wednesday. If you want to hear this again, or if you think it's really important, which it is important information, please share this with your friends. You can go to my website at sarahwestall.com. You can see the YouTube video that I have up there. The podcast will be up there. You can share the radio page with your friends and family, Facebook, Twitter, wherever. It's really good that this information gets out. Of course, I'll have the contact information for you to see what they're doing. And he's involved in all sorts of different nonprofit activities and things. So I'll have information there up as well on things that he's doing, and you can learn more. Maybe you want to get involved and volunteer in some of the work that's going on. So for now, I hope everybody has an amazing day.